This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I hope you stick around. We're going to bring you some interesting reports in the next half hour. WMRA's Emily Richardson-Lorente introduces us to an impressive pair of high school students, young tech-savvy women in Charlottesville who are not only demonstrating that it's not just boys who can excel at computer science, but who are also taking those skills to the marketplace, building their own business that helps seniors with their technology issues. We also take a look back at the convening of the 2017 Virginia General Assembly last week, with a report on the session's first day and Governor Terry McAuliffe's State of the Commonwealth address, plus some analysis of how the session is shaping up. All of that coming up in the next half hour. But first, the cost of living has steadily risen in Charlottesville, as has the average income. But what happens when the city's lowest wage earners can no longer afford to live there? Part of this trend, of course, is being driven by the growing demand for housing by the University of Virginia community, including students. But that's not the whole story. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this report on the state of affordable housing in Charlottesville.
A giant excavator shovels hundreds of crumbled cinder blocks along West Main Street, clearing the remnants of an old office building. A new six-story apartment building called The Standard is set to take its place, adding nearly 650 bedrooms to Charlottesville's rental market. But not one of these will be priced as affordable for lower-income residents in the city. Instead, they're aimed at University of Virginia students.
That's what all you hear about Charlottesville is students, 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 students. You don't really hear too much about single mothers trying to, you know, do the right thing by working and trying to make a living for their family. You hear about students.
Sharonda Poindexter-Rose is a single mother. She's 24 years old and works as a server at a local restaurant. Over the last several months, she sought to upgrade her one-bedroom home to a two-bedroom. But along the way, she's discovered a hard truth about Charlottesville's housing market.
It's so expensive. Like, really, it is. It's expensive out here.
Most two-bedrooms in Charlottesville range between $1,000 to $1,800 a month, according to a recent study commissioned by the city. That's on par with Virginia Beach, according to U.S. Census data, and exceeds average rents in cities such as Richmond, Roanoke, and Harrisonburg. 6 years ago, Charlottesville set a goal that by the year 2025, it wants 15% of all housing to be affordable for two-person families making less than $52,000 a year. Since setting that goal, more than 1,500 new housing units have been built in the city, but only 73 of them have been priced as affordable. As a result, the percentage of affordable housing in the city has actually decreased slightly from 10.1% to 10.06%. Stacy Pethia was hired in August to be the city's housing program coordinator. From a business standpoint, she says she gets it. Developers make less profit with affordable housing, and legally, they don't have to build it. A local ordinance allows them to pay a lump sum into the Charlottesville Affordable Housing Fund instead.
I think historically, the developers generally pay into the fund as opposed to providing units. I would like that to change.
Pethia oversees the fund, which was started in 2007 to try and increase the city's affordable housing. That apartment building under construction on West Main Street, it'll join two others of equal size, recently built, and also aimed at student tenants. Altogether, their developers paid nearly $1.5 million into the fund, rather than making a few of their 560 units affordable to lower-income residents. None of these three developers returned requests for comment. Pethia worries that trend towards more expensive housing will continue.
Because what I think we don't want to happen is that all of the new housing that comes in is high-end, and people who are of moderate or lower income need to move farther and farther away from the city. So that would hurt the future of the city itself.
Anecdotally, people are moving away to places within driving distance, such as Waynesboro or Scottsville, but where two bedrooms go for less than half as much. According to a recent report, it costs about $35,000 a year to be self-sufficient in Charlottesville. And perhaps more startling, one out of every four families here make less than that. Sure, Charlottesville's area median income is $84,000 a year, but that's a bit misleading, says Brandon Collins. He's an organizer with the Public Housing Association of Residents.
You have a lot of incomes that are on the very high scale that have skewed things so that our median income is actually pretty high, that we still have this very big divide between the very low or extremely low income people and the very wealthy in Charlottesville.
Collins says the Affordable Housing Fund needs more taxpayer dollars. Currently, the city gives it about $1.3 million a year. That money is then given mostly to area nonprofits to rehab existing homes and build new homes for low-income residents. But for those who rent, the market is sparse, and the message is clear, says Poindexter-Rose.
It comes across as if they don't care. You know what I'm saying? That's what the message comes across. It comes across as, to me, African Americans, we just do not care about. You know what I'm saying? We don't care about you all.
Last November, Pethia and the Housing Advisory Committee offered City Council a series of 35 recommendations on ways to increase affordable housing. One was to offer developers what are called density bonuses, permission to build larger buildings in exchange for a guaranteed number of affordable units. But it's not as easy as it sounds.
It's not always well-liked in cities, though, because it's changing the entire look of the city. And in Charlottesville, is still, it's not New York. I mean, it still has its little neighborhoods that are quaint and reasonably scaled. And to build affordable housing, we're going to have to change that.
The Great Eastern Management Company is part of that change. It's trying to be the first to incorporate affordable units into its housing plan instead of paying into the fund. But some say the four-story building the company's proposed is just too large for their upper-class neighborhood near downtown. And they've actively campaigned against the 126 units, at least four of which would be priced as affordable, says David Mitchell, who handles the company's construction and development.
It's tough, change is hard, but this city is changing, and it's going to become a city. It's not a town, and we need to plan for it, or the consequences are going to be pretty bad, I think, and the people that are going to hit the most are the ones that can't afford it.
One thing's for certain, cities change. The question is, for whom? For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
If you've ever grown frustrated trying to explain some super simple technology like texting to an older person, or if you're a senior citizen frustrated by the condescending way your grandkid told you that texting is super simple, this story by WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente is for you.
Picture a tech support team, and the duo of Duffy and Guy Magami may not come to mind. First off, because they're both women. Second, because they're only 17 years old.
Hello, I'm Leela Gaia-Magami. I'm a senior at St. Anne's Belfield School.
And hi, I'm Clara Duffy. I'm also a senior at St. Anne's Belfield School.
2 years ago, these two computer science-loving friends were taking a social entrepreneurship class, and they recognized an unmet need.
We noticed that our own grandparents had a lot of difficulty with their technology, things like printers, email, Facebook. They didn't really know how to use it, and we did.
So Clara and Leela started a business together called Seniors Connect. It offers tutoring and technology troubleshooting for older folks. Today they're at the Senior Center in Charlottesville, leading a free group class to half a dozen people.
We are here to help.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I have three questions.
A lot of times it's the same types of questions, like how do I attach a photo to an email, or how do I add things in Excel?
Or how do I print my Word document? Or
why can't I get my Windows 7 updates?
You want to update to Windows 10.
I want them. No, I do not want. Don't bite your tongue.
It's really fun to go around and individually help people and get to know them just a little bit.
Oh, did you scan your resume?
Maybe so.
That's Rob Myers. He's a dapper older gentleman, sporting a pair of bright plaid pants. He's on his way to a holiday party and stopped in for a little tech help first.
What can we do then?
This is actually his second time attending one of these sessions.
I think it's really good. I mean, the issue is that, you know, the world is run by technology these days, and it keeps changing, and we didn't have access to schooling in it. So we just fumble around.
Wait, let me see.
I can tell if that's it. Look at the date.
Granted, you could take just about any senior citizen in this country and compare him to just about any high school senior, and chances are that the more junior senior would know more about technology. But for anyone who's ever been annoyed by a technology lesson delivered by some know-it-all expert, Clara and Leela can empathize. Before Leela joined their high school's computer science program, Clara was the only girl there.
I was very new to all computer science things, and all the guys were like, oh yeah, like, I know all this. And I was so intimidated. So I think it's made me more aware about not acting, I guess, like I know it all, because I know that I don't. Okay, it looks like you might need to buy something.
Oh.
Which is really annoying.
Yeah. And Leela says there's an advantage to being a young woman in this business.
The elderly people feel a lot more comfortable letting us into their homes. They bring us snacks and tea and water. I think it even surprises them sometimes that we really do know our stuff.
It's right here.
Leela and Clara offer free classes like this in part to promote their private tutoring sessions, which they charge for. Usually.
I once had, I think, a 95-year-old woman call me because she had accidentally opened up 66 email tabs on her Mac, and I just went over and I just closed them all, and her computer was fine.
What do you charge for a service like that?
I said, I'm sorry, ma'am, I'm not going to charge you for this. This is completely free. Let me know if you have an actual issue.
Leela and Clara estimate that they've provided a few hundred private lessons over the last 2 years, and they actually have about 30 repeating customers. But there have been challenges.
We've never really scheduled things before because we're in high school and our parents do things like appointments for us. So this is just a little bit of a shock of having to schedule things like this group lesson and then remember to go to them.
Despite the occasional scheduling challenge, Seniors Connect seems to be connecting with people. Last year, Clara and Leela pitched their business concept at a local entrepreneurship festival, and they won. The youngest people ever to do so. What is it about entrepreneurship that appeals to you?
I really like the problem-solving aspect of it. So Leela and I saw a problem. Seniors don't know how to use technology and don't really have a good way to learn how. And we were able to solve that real-world problem, and that really excites me.
Of course, both young women may be heading out of state for college in the fall. So what's going to happen to their business?
We were hoping to get, like, sophomore or junior girls at our school who are kind of interested in the same things as we are, who would be willing to, you know, take our clients and treat them nicely.
One last thing, the name, Seniors Connect.
The one flaw with our name is that it sounds like it's a dating site, which it is not.
Which all the boys make fun of us for.
All of them. They're not very nice about it.
You guys could have thought of a better name, like maybe Seniors Hook Up to the Internet. Yeah. For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson Lorente.
The 2017 General Assembly session convened Wednesday in Richmond, and later that night, Governor Terry McAuliffe delivered his final State of the Commonwealth address. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope was there and filed this report on the speech and reaction from lawmakers.
Mr. President, His Excellency, the Governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
That's the last time Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe will hear those words, announcing him as His Excellency, as he enters a room full of friends and a few enemies. This week, McAuliffe once again walked into the House chamber to deliver his fourth and final State of the Commonwealth address, a mix of patting himself on the back for economic achievements and laying the groundwork for his agenda this year.
The agenda that I present to you this evening builds on the work that we have done together over the past 3 years. Every single proposal is tied directly to building a new Virginia economy that creates opportunity for families from every walk of life and every corner of our Commonwealth.
Some parts of the governor's agenda have already gained bipartisan support, like expanding mental health screening to keep people with behavioral disorders out of jails, or criminal justice reforms, like increasing the dollar amount of what qualifies as grand larceny. Other parts of the governor's agenda, though, are sure to cause conflict.
Let us go ahead and make 2017 the year that we make universal background checks for firearm sales the policy of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Last year, the governor was able to cut a deal on gun control that allowed both sides to get some of what they wanted. This year, though, Republicans say any effort to expand background checks is a non-starter. And then there's all those social issues that threaten to overwhelm the session this year, like restricting when a woman can have an abortion or which bathroom a transgender person can use.
I want to make it very clear that I will veto any legislation that discriminates against LGBT Virginians or undermines the constitutional health care rights of our Virginia women.
After the speech, Republican Speaker Bill Howell said he liked some of what the governor had to say about jobs and the economy, but he added much of what the governor had to say was divisive.
For a guy that doesn't like to talk about social issues, it's all about social issues and gun issues and things like that. And you kind of wonder why he brings all those things up if he talks about wanting to act to get work together.
Democratic Senator Chet Peterson of Fairfax says he's pleased the governor is finally on board with increasing the threshold for grand larceny from $200 to $500.
I think I first proposed this bill in 2003. It was myself and Ken Cuccinelli. We brought this bill in 2003. It got defeated. But I have brought this bill practically every year I've been in the legislature.
Republican Senator Emmett Hanger of Stanton says he disagrees with the governor's proposal to give state employees a one-time bonus instead of a raise.
Our preference would be to determine how much money we can afford within our existing revenues and actually put a base increase in salary for state employees rather than a bonus.
One area where both sides might be able to find some common ground is mental health reform. Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security Brian Moran says now is the time to act.
Every jail, all 63 jails, will have the same screening apparatus and process so that we can identify the mental illness and then assess it to determine its the individual's needs and then provide those services.
By this time next year, Virginia will have a new governor with different priorities. That means McAuliffe has the next few weeks to craft a legacy for things he wants to accomplish, as well as any contrast he wants to make with Republicans. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Let's get some analysis now of Virginia politics, including the first few days of the General Assembly and Governor McAuliffe's State of the Commonwealth address. Here is Craig Carper at our partner station, WCVE in Richmond, talking with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
Well, the 2017 General Assembly has begun with Governor Terry McAuliffe's State of the Commonwealth speech on Wednesday evening.
Listening to that speech, one would think that everything in Richmond is happy, happy, joy, joy. The governor went on at great length, almost an hour, about this great tradition of bipartisanship and how that has allowed the Republican legislature and his Democratic administration to accomplish great things. I suspect that the address was bipartisan in this respect. It gave Democrats something to run on and gave Republicans something to run against. And the topics on which the parties tend to find consensus relatively quickly, traditionally, economic development, balancing the budget, schools. But the governor spent a good deal of time talking about those issues on which there is little or no consensus. For example, abortion rights, gay rights, gun control. There was some reference to Bob Marshall's North Carolina-like bathroom bill. The governor has said he is prepared to use his veto to protect Virginians from the ideological excesses of the Republican General Assembly. That all takes on greater significance now, because this is an election year. All 100 House seats are up, and of course, Virginians will be choosing Terry McAuliffe's replacement as governor. And it was clear when the governor hit some of those themes that are so important to Democrats, the huzzas went up and among the Democrats, and the Republicans tended to sit very quietly.
And these lawmakers will be pushing forward a lot of legislation, though this is a 46-day session, so a bit less than they would during the full 60-day session.
There are a lot of bills that are going to be introduced only to, shall we say, perfect the record. Legislators in both parties know they're not going anywhere, but they want to at least get it in the record that they were for it or against it. It's something that they like to talk about when they're campaigning for re-election. One of the more interesting bills is one that would restore state oversight of the electric utility business. Remember that Dominion, among other companies, went to the state and said because of the financial uncertainty accompanying the federal clean energy plan, that it was important that the company be allowed to keep all of its cash. Well, the legislature happily went along. After all, Dominion throws around a lot of money in the way of campaign contributions and fields a virtual army of lobbyists. Well, Chap Peterson is a state senator from Northern Virginia saying, well, let's restore oversight of the utilities, oversight by the State Corporation Commission, if, as Donald Trump says he will, does away with the clean energy plan.
And 100 miles up the road, the confirmation hearings are underway for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet. Trump's nominees are getting questioned intensively, and two of the members doing the questioning are our own Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine.
Mark Warner sits on the Intelligence Committee, which is vetting, for example, the president-elect's choice for the Central Intelligence Agency. Tim Kaine sits on three marquee committees: Armed Services, Foreign Relations, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And some of the more controversial cabinet picks have to be vetted by these committees. I think what makes this assignment particularly interesting for Tim Kaine is that as the defeated vice presidential nominee, maybe to some degree within the setting of a Senate committee hearing, he relitigates some of the issues of the 2016 campaign. This is also an opportunity for Kaine to really talk up issues that are important to the Democratic base. He is seeking re-election in 2018, an off year when turnout falls, when the full energies of the few Democrats who participated will be required to preserve him as a United States senator.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, Richmond Times-Dispatch columnist and WCVE's political analyst. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Mention the object black hole, and thoughts immediately turn to a large, dark behemoth that sucks everything in its vicinity, sort of like a giant vacuum cleaner. The truth, however, is that you must venture very close to one for that to happen. And now it appears we've caught a supermassive black hole doing exactly that, tearing a star to shreds and then devouring it. Massive stars, some 7 to 10 times the mass of our sun, are kind of like the Hollywood celebrities of the cosmos. They live fast and die young. Massive stars quickly run through their reservoir of hydrogen in their core, after which gravity inevitably wins and causes the star to explode in a brilliant supernova. Recently, astronomers recorded the brilliant flash of what they thought was a massive star exploding. Spotted in 2015 by a robotic all-sky survey looking for transient objects, this flash was weird from the beginning. For one, this event was the brightest flash ever seen if it occurred from a massive star exploding. Secondly, it occurred in a type of galaxy that is no longer forming new massive stars. So what's going on? Using data provided from the Hubble Space Telescope, as well as telescopes from the ground, astronomers learned that the flash occurred very close to the center of its host galaxy, and not out in the suburbs, where we typically see supernovae in other galaxies. Even weirder, follow-up observations showed that after initially fading as expected, the object began growing brighter several weeks after the event that created the flash. All these clues now point to a different story. Rather than a massive star exploding in a cataclysmic supernova, we now think that a low-mass star ventured too close to the supermassive black hole lurking in the galactic center. As it did, the star was ripped apart by the extreme gravitational field exerted by the black hole, causing the flash. After it was ripped apart, the debris collected into a pancake-like disk before falling into the black hole, giving rise to the brightness observed weeks after being ripped apart. The forensic evidence in this case seems clear. Death by black hole. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bip and Ollie Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Pam and Jim Huggins, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.